For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
Good evening. This timely topic of tonight's class is the centrality of the land of Israel. The centrality of land of Israel. To what extent Israel is at the center of the Judaism that we practice, of the theology of being Jewish. And the reason it's so timely, as most of you know, as I was just discussing in the back, is that in a few short hours, the polls will be opening in Israel tomorrow. As many of you know, there are elections being held for the 20th Knesset out in Israel. And a lot of us know that there are elections. Most of us have little familiarity with the process. Those of us that have some familiarity with the process wish we didn't. And it's complicated, it's wild, it's exciting, it's extremely democratic. Some would argue it's a little bit too democratic, but it's something that that as Jews it's certainly worth celebrating. In contrast, I just recalled a interesting news story from the end of 2013 in Azerbaijan in Asia. There is technically a president, but the election is such a farce that some of you may have seen this article that the day before the elections they accidentally released the result in 2013. It's a true story. It actually happened. So we have to count our blessings in the countries that we do live in that in fact at least the elections are decided on the day of, opposed to the day before. Okay. Now in contrast, in Israel we don't know what the results will be, and hopefully it'll be good for the Jewish people. Now, of the dozens of parties that are technically running, and there are dozens of parties running, it's pretty easy to start a political party there, only 11, as of, I believe now, have something of a chance to cross what they call as the minimum threshold in order to make it into the Knesset. And certainly when it comes to the Jewish parties, and for sure, the parties that are primarily observant, one of the core issues that differentiate between the different parties is to what extent they view the fact that the land of Israel is at the center of our theology, of our belief system, to what extent should that play a role in the modern politics of running a state? Right? Is that fact compatible and relevant with today's political and security realities? So tonight I don't really want to talk too much about contemporary issues as they pertain to the modern state of Israel. Of course we'll talk about it because it's a modern manifestation of everything we're going to be talking about. But hopefully we'll steer clear of some of the more controversial issues that are contemporary. Of course we could bring them up afterwards and try to focus more on historically what does Jewish text, what do the rabbis from the time periods of the Mishnah, from the time periods of the Talmud, and on until today, what do they say about how important the land of Israel is to us and to who we are as Jews? Now we say in America, you know, we often sing, this land is your land, this land is my land. And this all, it sounds nice, but when it comes to Israel and the Jewish people, it actually is true. And it's not just true in an abstract, you know, kind of nice poetic way, but the truth is that in terms of halacha and the way Jewish law functions, every single Jew has a portion in the land of Israel. Every single Jew. And that plays itself out on a variety of levels. I mean, the most simple level, one example I'll share with you is that more so that, besides for the fact that the land of Israel belongs to all of us as a whole, but Jerusalem belongs to the collective Jewish people to the extent that, as you know, three times a year there's a the pilgrimage holidays. We have Pesach, we have Shavuos, we have Sukkot. When all Jewish males used to go up to Jerusalem to encounter Hashem himself, to encounter God, the Almighty, in the temple. And it was quite a scene, as you can imagine. You have hundreds of thousands, millions of Jewish males going up to Jerusalem. And finding a place to stay was extremely difficult. And Jewish law says clearly that it is forbidden for anybody in Jerusalem to charge for beds in their home for visitors from outside of Jerusalem. And the reason is that Jerusalem belongs collectively to the Jewish people. So you can't charge me for a bed that's on my own land, right? That doesn't work. So this is just one small example of this idea that really the land of Israel belongs to each of us. And even those of us who have never been to Israel, and certainly our ancestors hadn't, a lot of them had not been to Israel, but the relationship is more than a nice, emotional, abstract, poetic idea. It's actually legal. And that plays itself out on a variety of levels. And so I'd like to focus on the idea that the land of Israel is central to the belief system of Judaism and to show how it's tied together with the Torah of Israel and the people of Israel, that Judaism is connected strongly to the land of Israel and to Torah as one whole package. Now, of course, we also have a very strong emotional relationship to Israel. That's for sure. In the times of the Talmud, which is after the destruction of the Temple, the times of the Talmud, roughly up until the year from roughly the year 200 to the year 500 of the Common Era, we are told that there were great rabbis who used to literally go and kiss the stones of Israel. And of course, many of us know the scenes of Jews who are overcome with emotion when they first set foot on Jewish soil and kissing the ground. But this goes back almost 2,000 years. And great rabbis would go and fix the roads in Israel, and literally, the Gemara says this, it's a fascinating thing, they would literally roll in the dirt of the land of Israel out of great love for the soil of this land. So there's a very strong emotional component that is, I think, is very different from almost anything else that's a major part of who we are as Jews. And the rabbis describe coming back to Israel, Jews coming from around the world, it's like a child coming back to the embrace of its mother. That's the imagery that's used to describe coming back to the land of Israel. There was a story with one of the early founders of modern Zionism. I forget his name, but at one point he was asked by a critic. He said, "Why is it so important that you have this piece of land? There are plenty of open areas throughout the world, other countries that are sparsely populated that you could try to work politically and otherwise to make it a state for the Jews. What is it about this piece of land that you're willing to jump through hoops, do whatever it takes to get access to this piece of land?" And he responded to him, I think, a beautiful response, which touches on the historic connection. He says that imagine if somebody has an elderly mother in a city that's far away, and he's making plans to go visit his mother, and a friend of his says, "Why are you bothering to go travel such a long distance to go visit your mother? There are plenty of elderly women in this neighborhood that you can go visit them. Why do you have to go such a far distance?" Right? So it's a great answer. The answer is, this is our mother. This is unique to us. There is no other land. This is who we are. And there was a Hasidish Rebbe, the Ostrovtzer, I believe this quote is attributed to others as well. He used to say that I am from the land of Israel, but because of our sins, we were exiled from there, and I'm forced to live in Europe, in Ostrovtsa, right? And he says that any Jew, any man who is asked, where is he from, right? He must answer, I am from the land of Israel, but at the moment, I am temporarily in Ostrovtsa or somewhere else. So where are we from? We are temporarily living in Atlanta. We are all collectively, we are all from the land of Israel as Jews. And so, certainly in light of the horrors that occurred, that happened to our people in the beginning of the last century, we have a very emotional relationship with the land. But what we're going to try to do here tonight is try to focus on let's go to the sources and discuss what is it about the land that historically has been so important, to us. So, those of you who have the sources, there's section number one in the sources. It's called, The Promise of the Land of Israel. And this goes through various verses in the Torah, where God gives the land of Israel as a inheritance to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, to all the forefathers, to Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and then down to our very generations, which is essentially the authority with which we come and claim the land. So the first source is Pasuk in Bereishis in chapter 12, and Abraham is instructed to go to the land, Lech Lecha, go forth. And Hashem says, go forth for your benefit, from your land, from your relatives, and I'll make you into a great nation, ve'eschel le'goy gadol, and through that you will be blessed, and, your name will be great, I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. And then, in source number two, he makes the same promise to Yitzchak. It's actually more explicit. And he says, God appears to Yitzchak, and he says, live in this land, and I will be with you, and I will bless you. For to you and your offspring I will give these lands, and establish the oath that I swore to Avram your father. I'm going to maintain an allegiance to this oath, and you and your offspring will get this land. Now, for those of us who are familiar with the various nations of the world and where they come from, that's not enough to guarantee our unique relationship with the land of Israel. Because, Yitzchak had a brother Yishmael, but he also had a son, Esav. And so in source number three, we have the promise of the land, of giving the land to Yaakov and to his offspring. It says, and God appeared to Yaakov again, and he came from Padan Aram, and he blessed him. And God said to him, your name is Yaakov, but you shall no longer be called Yaakov alone, but you shall also be called Yisrael, shall be your name. Right? And the land that I gave to Avram and to Yitzchak, I will give to you, and to your offspring after you, I will give the land. So this is pretty extremely explicit, where Hashem says, the land of Israel will be a very unique, designated inheritance for the offspring of Yaakov, for his children specifically. So carrying on through time. There was a rabbi in Israel, Rabbi Tzvi Yehuda Cook, who was the son of Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak Cook. So he was very fond of quoting. There was a early Zionist leader named Yitzchak Tabenkin. Some of the early Zionist leaders were pretty far removed from Jewish tradition, but he enjoyed quoting. He enjoyed this particular quote. Before the founding of the State of Israel, many of you know that the United Nations tried to create a partition plan, which was rejected by the Arab nations, which resulted in the War of Independence. And so when Tabenkin was asked, what are your thoughts about this UN partition? And he said that the land of Israel belongs to the grandfather who is no longer and to the grandson who is yet to be born. And it is therefore impossible to relinquish parts of it at all. So that's an interesting attitude that he had with a sensitivity to the historical reality that this is something that has been passed on. And moving on to source number four, this is also a series of quotes that I think are extremely timely, extremely relevant, because I don't want to scare anybody, but Pesach is coming in a couple weeks. And we find that the story of Passover is very much connected to the story, to the idea that the land of Israel belongs to the children of Israel. So in source number three, God takes the Jewish people out, of Egypt? And he says to Moshe, he says, I will come down to rescue them from the land of Egypt. And he doesn't stop there. He continues and he says, and to bring them up from that land to a good and spacious land, to a land flowing with milk and honey. So here we have the seminal event of Jewish history. When we became a nation, God takes us out of Egypt. He pulls us out of there and says, go be a nation. Go be my children and receive the Torah. Right? But part of that package is go to the land of Israel. And we find many places that going to the land of Israel, that leaving Egypt is linked directly to going, then moving on to the land of Israel. And of course, a very direct connection, as we know, at the Pesach Seder, we always end off, and we have ended off for many, many hundreds, if not thousands of years, we've ended off with Shana Haba'a B'Yerushalayim, next year in Jerusalem, which you would think is not so relevant to the idea that we left Egypt. I mean, of course, we wound up in Israel, but it's a little bit tangential, but we see that there's this strong connection. And in fact, in the second blessing of benching, the second blessing, we say, Nodelecha, thank you, God, for giving us this land, Eretz Chamda Tova Rechava, and then go straight into Va'al She'otzeisanu, this that you took us out from Egypt, right, and redeemed us. So again, we find this package deal. We leave Egypt, we come into the land of Israel. This is all part and parcel of this major event of us becoming a nation. Now, source number five is a quote from the book of Joshua, the book of Yoshua, the first book from the of the prophets. And of course, Yoshua took over from Moshe as the leader of the Jewish people to actually lead the Jewish people into the land of Israel. We'll talk a little bit about this more soon, but we know that Moshe himself never made it into the land of Israel, at least to the main part of the land of Israel, the holiest parts of the land, and he was forced to view it from the other side of the Jordan River. Those of you who have seen, who have been to Jerusalem, if you look out to the east, you see these towering cliffs of Jordan, and so he was able to look into the land, but he was not able to come in. And Yoshua leads them in. So in the book of Joshua, chapter 1, verses 2 through 4, it says, Hashem says to Yoshua, he says, Moshe has died, Moshe my servant has died, now arise, cross the Jordan, you and the entire people, to the land that I will give to them, to the children of Israel. And he says an important quote, he says, Kol makom asher tidroch kaf raglechem, any place that the sole of your foot will tread, bo lachem nasativ kasher dibarti al Moshe, I've given to you as I spoke to Moshe. And now he tells us the borders of the land of Israel. And for those of us familiar with the modern borders of the land of Israel, this will come as a bit of a surprise. He says, Mehamidbar v'halavanon, from the desert and this Lebanon, Hazev, Adar Nahar Gadol Nahar Paras, until the great river, which river? He specifies, Nahar Paras, the Euphrates River. Kol ha'aretz ha'chitim v'adei yam ha'gadol mevo ha'shem ha'shiyeg v'olchem. That all the land of the Chitim until the great sea towards the setting of the sun will be your boundary. So this is a description of a massive area of land that is far, far, far larger than a Jewish state pretty much has ever been. Even the times of King David and King Solomon, I don't even think it extended this far. But this is the ultimate promise of the land of Israel that will eventually be extending all the way through Jordan, certainly, and then all the way partially into Iraq to the Euphrates River. And just as a complete sidebar, this idea is actually flips. If you're around certain people who enjoy flipping the narrative on modern Israel issues, So it's actually very fascinating, because very often in contemporary discussions about modern Israel, people bring up the occupied West Bank, right? So people who quote this verse, instead they'll flip it around and they'll talk about the occupied East Bank, that the East Bank of the Jordan is occupied and it actually belongs to the Jewish people, right? And similarly, you have the northern borders of Israel don't stop where they are in current times. They actually extend into Lebanon. So Lebanon, which was, people talked about occupied southern Lebanon, is really northern Israel. And so you can kind of flip things around. And just interesting historical side note, I believe last year it was the Great Jewish Controversies series. So there was a class about the three Jewish underground organizations that fought against the British and eventually forced the British out of the Palestine Mandate to create the State of Israel. And I assume you learned about the three major organizations. There were the Haganah, there was the Irgun, also known as Eitzel, and there was Lehi. And so the Irgun, which was headed by Menachem Begin, who eventually became Prime Minister of Israel, who at one point was the single most wanted man in the entire British Empire for what he was doing to the British. The Irgun symbol, if any of you have seen it, is actually it's a map of modern Israel and Jordan, the entire thing. And there's an outstretched arm holding a rifle, and underneath it says Rakach. Only thus, only through arms can we liberate the land. But historically, they believed that the land of Israel should not just include the land, certainly shouldn't include what the UN partition asked for, but should not only include all the land west of the Jordan River, should also include all the land east of the Jordan River. And over time, that ideal became untenable to some extent. But there was an Israeli politician, some of you may have heard of, his name was Rehavam Ze'evi. Rehavam Ze'evi was an extremely colorful guy. He was a very highly decorated army general. Some of you may, there's a iconic photo after the Six-Day War of the three generals walking out of Lion's Gate of Jerusalem. There was Yitzhak Rabin, who was the chief of staff. There was Moshe Dayan, who was the defense minister, and the commander of the Jerusalem Brigade, who was Uzi Narkis. And in that photo, right behind them, there's a tall man looking back. You can't see his face. That's Rehavam Ze'evi. And at one point, he was the minister of tourism. And tragically, in 2001, Rehavam Ze'evi was actually assassinated in 2001 in the Hyatt Hotel in Jerusalem, right next to Mount Scopus, where Hebrew University is. Without getting into too much detail, he's an extremely colorful guy, but one of the things that he refused to have was any type of security with him. Even though he was a minister in the Israeli cabinet, he says he's going to carry his own weapon and defend himself. And he was targeted, he was assassinated. The hotel employees assisted the Arab terrorists, and he was killed in 2001. But one of the things he used to say, he was a big advocate of a one-state solution. He believed that only that the entire Israel should belong to the Jews. Any Palestinians who want their own state are welcome to go to Jordan. And he was perceived, and he is on the political spectrum, as an extreme right-winger to some extent. He was not an observant person, by the way. But he used to say, people used to say, how do you feel about being so right-wing? He used to say that back when I was younger, and we were fighting for this land, the right wing believed that we should have the entire Israel and Jordan, right? I was in the center. I was a centrist. Everybody else moved to the left. So suddenly I became a right winger, but really I'm in the center of the political discussion on this issue. So that's just an interesting anecdote about that. Okay, so let's move along to source number 6, which is a very, very important source, which is in fact the first Rashi in the entire Torah, the first comment by the legendary commentator, Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, Rabbi Shlomo Yarchi, who lived from the years 1040 to 1105 in France and Germany. So we have the first verse of the Torah, a famous verse. The verse says, "Bereishis bara Elokim," right? God created the heavens and the earth, etc., etc. So Rashi quotes a Medrash, and he quotes the opinion of Rabbi Yitzchak, and it's in the box on source number 6. So Rabbi Yitzchak says, he asks, Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, says Rabbi Yitzchak, Lo haya tzarich la'atchilas haTorah ela me'achodesh zelachem. The Torah should have started much later in the book of Exodus, in the book of Shemos, chapter 12, from the verses that talk about the new moon. Shehi mitzvah rishona shenitzdavu ba'Yisrael, because that is really the first commandment that the Jewish people, as a nation of Jews, was commanded to keep. Right, so my tam pasach with Bereishis. Why did we start with Bereishis? It's a good question. We have a series of 12 or so parshas that tell us the whole story of Bereishis and us becoming a nation. But ultimately, the Torah is a book of laws. So why didn't we start there? He says a very powerful answer. He says, and he quotes a verse in Tehillim, says, Koach ma'asav yigid la'amo, that he wanted to convey the message of the verse, that the power of his acts he told to his people, la'seis lahem nachalas gaim, to give to them the inherited land of the nations. She'im yomruhu mosa olam li'yisrael listem atem. If the Gentiles were ever to say to the Jews, you are listem, you are thieves. Right? For you conquered the lands of the seven nations, right? The land of Israel used to be called Eretz Canaan, the land of Canaan, the Canaanites. They were there. So they'll say, what are you doing? You stole their land. So Israel will say to them, the entire world belongs to the HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to the Holy One, blessed be. He created it. He gave it to the one who he found proper in his eyes. By his wish he gave it to them, and by his wish he took it from them and gave it to us. So why do we start from Bereishis? What's the reason? According to Rabbi Yitzchak, it's only to come to combat those who deny our right to legally enjoy the land of Israel. To respond to them and tell them that no, God created the world, God decides who it goes to. And in fact, there was an interesting moment in, I believe it was 2005, 2006, when there's the current minister of, I think internal affairs in Israel at the moment is a fellow named Gilad Erdan. And Gilad Erdan, he's number three on the Likud list. He'll be elected to the Knesset tomorrow. So he once got up in the Knesset, and there is a Arab Knesset member named Ahmed Tivi, who was an advisor to Yasser Arafat. He does not like the Jews so much. And so Gilad Erdan got up there, and his entire speech was, he literally read this Rashi. He said, I just want to teach you something. And he read it through to him. So that was interesting. But the truth is that those of you who participate in the we have a Wednesday afternoon Chumash class will know that we recently came across a verse where actually we know that after the great flood, so Hashem divided up the earth to all different, to the three sons of Noach, Shem, Ham, and Yafes, and the land of Israel falls into the portion of Shem, and of course we are Semites, we are descendants of Shem, and Canaan is not a descendant of Shem. And so later on, as time went on, the Canaanites, the Canaan, who are descendants of Ham, they came illegally and took control of the land of Israel. And so when Abraham comes back into the land, right, essentially what he's doing is he's reconquering or retaking land that historically belonged to his family. So the claim as quoted in Rashi isn't factual to begin with either. This actually relates, there's an interesting story that appears in the Gemara and Sanhedrin in the Talmud. There's a series of cases that came before Alexander the Great against the Jewish people. And assuming it's actually referring to Alexander the Great, the Gemara doesn't sometimes uses that name interchangeably, but it probably happened in the 300s before the Common Era. And the story goes that the Canaanites come to Alexander the Great and they said, the Jews stole our land. And Alexander says, how do you know? He says, well, ask them. The land that they took was the land of Canaan. And so Alexander says, that's a good point. So he calls the Jews in and he says to the Jews, what can you respond to these people? They seem to have a very legitimate claim. And so the Jews said, give us a few days. So they go back, they're trying to look through the law books, what are we going to respond to these people? And was there a hunchback named Gavia ben Psisa, we're told, and Gavia said, let me respond before Alexander the Great on your behalf. If I have a good argument, then that's great. You just won the argument. And if I don't, you could say he's some hunchback who we don't really know, and he's not really, he wasn't really part of our team of lawyers. And give us more time to debate. So Gavia goes before Alexander the Great, and he says to Alexander the Great, what is the source of these people's claim? And Alexander says to the Canaanites, what's your source? And they said, look in the Torah. It says that the Jewish people took the land of Canaan. And so Gavia says, well, if the Torah is your source, and the Torah also says that all of the descendants of Canaan will be slaves to the other brothers of Noah, to the other children of Noah, right? And so technically, you're our slaves if you're using this legal source. So actually, we wanna demand from you the back wages or the cost that we lost now of your labor for all these centuries, in addition to the fact that we're gonna keep your land. So this story goes, Alexander said to the Canaanites, you have 3 days to respond, and they fled and they never came back. There's a series of these stories. There's another story with the descendants of Ishmael and Africans and others, etc. Okay. So let's look at source number 7. It's a source that comes with this, that's in the part of this curriculum, the the verse in Yoel, the book of Yoel, it says that the nation of Israel is called my people and the land of Israel is called my land. All right, so God says, I'll gather the nations, bring them down to the valley of Yehoshaphat. I'll contend with them about how they treated my people and my possessions, Israel, and that they dispersed and the fact that they divided up my land. So the Gentiles will be held accountable for those who take Jewish land. Okay, and Hashem very often, there are midrashim that talk about how the land of Israel belongs to God, the nation of Israel belongs to God, and that it's all one unit. So, what are the physical qualities of the land? So section number two, what are the physical qualities? So the verses in Devarim and Deuteronomy chapter 8 talk about a lush and fertile land. It says, Hashem is bringing you to a good land, a land with streams of water, springs, and underground water coming forth in a valley and mountain, land of wheat, barley, grape, fig, and pomegranate. We know these are the olives and the date honey, the seven species. A land where you will eat bread without poverty. You will lack nothing there, a land whose stones are iron and whose mountains you will mine copper. You will eat and be satisfied, etc., etc. So it's a great land. Now, and then the next source, there's in the times of the Talmud, Rami, the son of Yecheskel, saw goats eating under the fig trees. Honey was dripping from the figs, and milk was flowing from the goats, and they mixed together, and he's talked about how this is a land flowing with milk and honey. So, before we get to some sources which show that the land was not always flowing with milk and honey, there's a source number three is an interesting source. There's a source from Josephus. Now, who was Josephus? Just a quick explanation of who he was. Josephus was a Jewish zealot. He was a Jew who was leading, one of the leaders of the great revolt against the Romans, which eventually culminated in the Jews losing the revolt and the Second Temple being destroyed roughly in the year 70 of the Common Era. So Josephus was up in the Galilee, which has always been a hotbed of Jewish resistance and revolution. It was for hundreds of years, through the Greek occupation, through the Roman occupation, And Josephus was leading a group of Jews who were fighting against the Romans, and the Roman army comes and eventually corners them all in a cave. And as many Jews did in that time period, most of you have probably heard of the story of Masada, they decided rather than surrender to the Romans and be paraded through the streets of Rome, instead we are going to commit suicide. And so how did they go about doing that? Like the same way as Masada. What did they do? They all wrote their name on a piece of probably clay, and they put it in, and they all pulled lots. And whoever's lot was pulled, somebody else killed him, because it's better to be killed by somebody rather than kill somebody themselves. And as they got down to the last person, the last man standing was Josephus. And similar to what happened at Masada, Josephus, to some people at Masada, Josephus said, "I'm not killing myself," and he actually surrendered after all of his comrades were killed. So, he joined the Roman forces, and he became a translator for the Romans, but what's amazing about Josephus is that he was living live through the destruction of the temple, saw what things were like before the destruction of the temple, afterwards, and literally he wrote volumes and volumes in great detail of what life was like. An incredible thing to have a first-person account like this, especially from somebody who was a Jewish revolutionary. And a lot of Jews are not, especially from that time period, were not very fond of Josephus because they viewed him as a turncoat. He's somebody who turned against the Jewish people. He aided and abetted the enemy while they were destroying the temple and massacring tens of thousands of Jews. So in Josephus, in one of his books, in the Jewish Wars, the Wars of the Jews, he says that he describes the land of Israel, and it's consistent with what the verses say in Devarim. It says, "From the whole area is excellent for crops or pasturage and rich in the trees of every kind. That by its fertility, it invites even those least inclined to work on the land, etc." He says, "Every inch is cultivated. It's thickly covered in towns. There's an abundance of soil. Villages are densely populated, etc., etc. Land of Israel is teeming with people. The land is fertile. Things are growing. It's an incredible place." Now, we know that from the times of the destruction of the temple until now, and we're going to quote some sources soon, that was not the case. Until fairly recently, that was not the case. And the Talmud in Sanhedrin, in source number four, quotes a commentary on that passage in the Talmud, but the Talmud in Sanhedrin says clearly, as Rashi explains, that the clearest sign of that the redemption is coming is that the land of Israel gives forth its fruits. There is no clearer sign. It is explicit. In the Talmud, it says, "Ein lecha ketz megula mizeh." There is no clearer sign than the fact that the land gives forth its fruits. And thank God we've been blessed to witness that actually happen in real time. As we see the barren parts of the land of Israel blooming and the rest of it. So what are some sources that indicate that up until recent history, since the Jewish people started coming en masse to Israel, that the land has not been so fertile? So there's many of you are probably familiar with a volume that was authored by Mark Twain after his travels throughout much of the world, to Europe and parts of the Middle East. He wrote a book called Innocents Abroad. And in the year 1867, he actually went to Jerusalem and he toured everything. A lot of it was from the Christian perspective, but he saw Jerusalem. In fact, he stayed in a hotel in the Muslim quarter called the Mediterranean Hotel. I was actually there a few weeks ago with Andy Lewis, and he mentioned that it was called Beit Wittenberg, right? I think he said something about some tour that you did. But actually that particular hotel, which is still around today and will be made into some kind of museum about Mark Twain, was actually purchased by Ariel Sharon, who was then Prime Minister of Israel, when things were very volatile in the Old City of Jerusalem, and he wanted to show that Jews have a right to live in any parts of the Old City that they choose. And so Ariel Sharon bought this building. It's really, I think, a couple apartments that literally sit on top of, it's kind of a bridge on top of the main thoroughfare in the Muslim quarter of the Old City. And so Mark Twain, when he's traveling through the land, he describes a incredibly desolate place. He writes, the desolation is there. You can't imagine this place having any people living here. And the mountains of Judea are barren. And he mocked the fact that the Jordan River was a small creek, and et cetera, et cetera. He goes through several pages just describing how this land that he only knew growing up from reading the Bible, he expected it to be a place flowing with milk and honey, was in fact a barren and deserted place. So what happened? And what happened is, as the rabbis in the Talmud say clearly, and as the prophets have said before them, that when the Jewish people are not in the land does not give forth its fruit. And when the Jewish people come back to the land, they do give forth the fruit. And that's pretty miraculous. The land itself is supernatural. It's above the laws of nature. And essentially, is waiting. It's waiting for the return of the Jewish people. This is pretty incredible. And then the subsequent sources in this unit, in this section, sources 5 and 6, and 7, they talk about how how land of Israel is higher than other lands. And it's obviously not physical, because the land of Israel is not only not the highest of the lands, but in fact, Jerusalem is not the highest. If you look at the topography, it's not the highest, but there's a spiritual elevation. And of course, when we talk about moving to Israel, we say we make Aliyah. We go up to Israel. There we go up, and that's the terminology we use. I'd just like to talk a little bit about the importance of how we speak about the land of Israel. The saddest date on the Jewish calendar is the 9th of Av. Now, the 9th of Av is the date of the destruction of the first temple, the second temple, but even before that, what happened on the 9th of Av is that way back when the Jewish people were in the desert, God sent, Moshe sent forth these meraglim, the spies, to spy out the land of Israel, and of course they came back, and most of them came back with a negative report. And they said things about the land that they should not have said. And as a result of that, right? As a result, they were crying about, out of fear, to go into the land of Israel. So God said, as the Medrash quotes him, saying, if you're crying now, this will be a night of crying and sobbing through all time. And sad things have happened on this date throughout Jewish history. And they wandered in the desert for 40 years as a result. Most of the people living it during that time period did not merit to make it to the land of Israel. And the reason is the verse says, Ya'an ki masnu, because we did not find the land of Israel attractive. And so there's always been the sensitivity about talking negatively about the land of Israel. In fact, the Mishnah in Tractate Sota says beautifully, it says, the Mishnah says, this is the source for why we have to be so careful about talking negatively about other human beings. Because when we talked about sticks and stones, we had such a horrible punishment that continues until modern time. Certainly when you talk about other Jews, other human beings, how much more so, that's a horrible thing, right? So that's a source. And throughout history, we find in the Talmud, the rabbis of the Talmud were very careful not to talk negatively about the land at all. I'm going to bring you some interesting cases here. There were two rabbis who are described that when they would teach their students, if they would be in the sun and it would be a hot day, right, they would immediately be careful, they would be sure to move from the sun into the shade. And if they would be in the shade and it would be too cool, they would move from the shade into the sun. Why? The reason is, the commentaries say, so that they would not indirectly cause their students to say, it is too hot or it is too cold in the land of Israel. Right? Which is a pretty incredible thing. So as not to cause that. The chief rabbi of Baghdad around 100 years ago, commonly known as the Ben Ish Chai after one of his works, Rabbi Yosef Chaim of Baghdad, fascinating, fascinating person. He actually, on this particular passage in the Talmud, he says that not only should you not talk negatively about the land itself, but even buildings that are built in the land of Israel, to describe them in a disparaging manner is something that a person should refrain from doing. And he takes it further. He says not only buildings, but even buildings built by Gentiles in the land of Israel. You should not talk negatively about those buildings. Pretty incredible thing. Just as a personal anecdote, I was once walking in Tzfat, in the holy city of Tzfat, in northern Israel, and the chief rabbi of Tzfat is a very colorful, interesting rabbi named Rabbi Shmuel Eliyahu, who's the son of the former chief rabbi of Israel, Rabbi Mordechai Eliyahu. And Rabbi Shmuel Eliyahu, in addition to being chief rabbi of Tzfat, is what you would call a hardliner in terms of his attitude towards the Arab residents of Israel, and to the extent that they should, you know, if they don't accept the fact that it's a Jewish state, they really shouldn't be there. So I went over to him and I said, Rabbi, this commentary says that you shouldn't talk negatively about any buildings, including buildings built by Gentiles. Do you believe that this would extend even to villages, let's say, that are populated even by hostile Arab terrorists, nests in Judea and Samaria? Would you extend it to that? And he said, absolutely. He says, even there, you should not talk negatively about the buildings and the structures in these places, which I thought was very interesting. So that's the deal about talking negatively about the land. And of course, each person on their own level, it's obviously very difficult if you're in Israel in August and July to not say anything negative about the weather. But to whatever extent a person can, build that type of sensitivity to appreciate that it's not like any other land, but there is something to be cautious about. So section number 3 is called The Purpose of the Land of Israel. Right? And as the introduction here says, that the Jewish people have dwelled in many host countries whose natural resources are comparable to the land of Israel. Right? As we know, the land of Israel has beautiful mountains, but, you know, with all due respect, if you go to parts of Europe, you will see mountains that are much taller and possibly more majestic. So what is this? What is it about the land? Is it purely the natural resources, or is it in fact, is there actually a spiritual resource that is really the source of the land's pride? So there's actually an incident with, I believe it was Rav Kook, Rav Avraham Yitzchak Kook, where he got stuck in Europe during World War One. He was a chief rabbi of Jaffa in Israel, and he left Israel to England, and he got stuck there due to World War One, and he was there for several years. But he was in the Swiss Alps, I believe, with Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, who was the author of the Sri Deish. And, Rabbi Weinberg was talking about how beautiful these mountains are. And what Rav Kook said to him, he said something beautiful. He said, these mountains are beautiful. He said, but the difference is that the mountains in the land of Israel, if you have the right spiritual sensitivity, they have a talent that these mountains don't have. At the land of Israel, the mountains actually speak to you. If you know how to listen, they actually speak to you. The topography of the land speaks to you, which is interesting. I think many of you who have been to Israel feel that to some extent, whatever language the mountain is speaking, but it's something deeply poetic. And we know that, of course, Moshe was desperate to come into the land of Israel. Eventually, God told him he can't come in. It was a punishment for a sin that he committed. And the reason he wanted to come in, the Talmud says, it's not because he wanted to taste from the delicious fruits, but because of the spiritual bounty that existed and the mitzvahs that you're able to fulfill. Now, the land of Israel as a place to perform mitzvot. So the verse in Devarim, chapter 6, says God is telling the Jewish people, this is the commandment, the decrees, the ordinances God commanded you to perform in the land. You shall observe to perform them in the land of Israel, etc., specifically in the land of Israel. And there's a passage from Nachmanides, from the Ramban. Nachmanides, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, who was a Spanish doctor and great, great sage, he says something, he quotes a Sifri, which is from the time period of the Talmud, I believe. Yeah, from the Talmud. And he says that all keeping of the mitzvahs, all, that when a Jew keeps the mitzvahs, the commandments outside of the land of Israel, it is only a rehearsal for the real thing. Right? So when we are making Pesach, for example, or keeping any other mitzvah, of course we're doing it, God wants us to be doing it out of the land of Israel, but the only reason we're doing it is so that we won't become rusty. So that when we go back to the land, we'll be able to seamlessly integrate into the behavior that we're supposed to be doing there specifically. And we have the quote over here. It's in quote number two. It says, the sages stated in the Sifri that if your heart leads you astray, etc., said, even though I, God, am exiling you from the land of Israel, you should still perform mitzvot so that when you return, they will not be new and unfamiliar to you. And he quotes an analogy. You have a man who's upset with his wife and sends her to her father's house. He says to her, keep wearing your jewelry so that when you return, they will not be new and unfamiliar to you. Which is an incredible statement. It's a very bold statement. It's rooted in Jewish tradition that, of course, we're doing God's will by keeping the mitzvot here, by keeping the mitzvot here. But we're doing it to stay in practice, so that we stay in shape and we don't get rusty. And so when we go back and we're actually living the optimal Jewish experience, we're able to do what we're supposed to do without having to be ignorant of the way we go through the motions of keeping these commandments. And living in the land of Israel is a mitzvah. It is a mitzvah. And it's pretty much across the board, everybody agrees. It's a verse. I mean, the verse says, you shall go up to the land of Israel, you shall inherit it. And from that verse through modern times, across the board, pretty much, there is consensus that living in the land of Israel always was a mitzvah and always will be a mitzvah. When the temple is built, when the temple is not built, it extends until today. So, and the Ramban, Nachmanides, lists it as one of the 613 mitzvahs, as one of the positive commandments to go up to the land of Israel and to live there. So the question is, why are there so many God-fearing Jews who do not live in the land of Israel? It's a fair question if it is a mitzvah. And there's no really, really good answer, but the best answer probably is, the question was posed to Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, and Rabbi Moshe Feinstein responded, by making, the following case, and he says that mitzvahs can be broken down. There are two major categories of mitzvahs. Okay, there's one category which in Hebrew is called a mitzvah chiyuvis, a mitzvah that is incumbent and obligatory upon every Jew to keep, no matter what. You have to keep Shabbos. You have to keep kosher. You need to. And there's another mitzvah called a mitzvah kiyumis, which is if you don't do it, you're not doing anything wrong. But if you do do it, you get a mitzvah. What's an example? So the example he used, which is a classic example, is wearing tzitzis, wearing the fringes on a four-cornered garment. Right, the Torah says explicitly, if you're a male and you're wearing a four-cornered garment, you need to put tzitzis on that garment. Right? But let's say a person's not wearing four-cornered garments, then he does not have to put the fringes on that garment. Right? Now, of course, there's evolved a custom amongst Jewish males to wear tzitzis, because if you have an opportunity to keep a mitzvah, and it's a fairly easy one to keep, then why would you not keep it? Right? But, so similarly, says Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, living in the land of Israel today, if you're not living there, you're not a sinner. But if you are living there, you're doing a good thing. So, to each person on their own level, obviously if you're a Jew who's trying to fulfill any mitzvah that you can, and the circumstances work out for you on all the different sides of the issue, then of course making aliyah is a big mitzvah, no question about that. But he provides some level of justification for those of us who do not currently live in the land of Israel. And now a lot of people, just as an aside, because I've heard this misconception a lot of people have this misconception about that they conflate the idea of living in Israel with the existence of the modern state of Israel. And so, as many of you have probably know, that there are certain small sects of Jews who are ideologically opposed to the idea of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel. All right, they believe, for reasons that are rooted in the Talmud, which one Hasidish Rebbe specifically, the Rabbi Yoel of Satmar, the Satmar Hasidim, they have a particular passage in the Talmud that they understand as being relevant nowadays. 99.9% of other rabbis completely disagree, and for very legitimate reasons, they explain that it's not an issue. But they feel very strongly, and Rabbi Yoel felt very strongly, that Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel until the days of Mashiach is not something that we should be doing. And so people often ask, how do they live in Israel? And the answer is, there's a difference between supporting what they believe, supporting the modern state of Israel as a Jewish sovereign entity, and supporting and believing that you should live in Israel. And many of them live in Israel, many of them make aliyah, and they live there because it's a mitzvah to live in the land of Israel. Now, of course, there are some of the more extreme ones, which usually wind up on the front page of your newspaper, commonly known as the Turi Karta, which take this ideology to an extreme level and usually gets our blood pressure skyrocketing. And they are very often seen visiting the Ayatollahs in Iran or protesting AIPAC or whatnot, and that makes a lot of people very, very angry. And the only response, the best response, I think, to that is I was one time in Israel with a group that I led, and we managed, through great fortune, to make it into the office of the Prime Minister of Israel. We didn't meet the Prime Minister, but we made it into the office, and we met with his spokesman, Mark Regev, and at the time, his advisor, who is a fellow named Ron Dermer, who is now Israel's ambassador to the United States, an incredibly intelligent, wonderful person. So one of the participants in this group raised her hand, and she asked Ron Dermer, she said, "What do you say about these extremist Hasidic Jews who oppose the state of Israel, do some very harmful, embarrassing things? This is terrible." She was going on and on. She was obviously felt very emotionally about it. And Ron Dermer had a great response, which I think holds very true and is applicable in a lot of different situations. He said that every society is entitled to have 5% crazy people. So he said, you're allowed to have up to 5%. That's the limit. Once it crosses 5%, then you can start asking questions about the society. Everybody says, up to 5%, you can have crazy people. So if you take the number of Jews that exist in this country, and you break it down even amongst observant Jews, even amongst Hasidic Jews, even amongst the Satmar Hasidim who believe this ideology, the percentage of people who are acting like this are so small. Of course, they make the headlines because it's a great scoop. But it's not a systemic problem if it's a very small number of people. And I think this holds true with a lot of the stereotypes and biases that peoples have with each other, that if you break down the statistics, it doesn't necessarily become as big of an issue. But certainly with them, I think a lot of people get very worked up about it. I know I do. And so it's good to keep that in mind. Okay. Sorry for that sidebar. So source number 4. This is a quote from the Sifri, also from the time period of the Talmud, and it says that dwelling in the land of Israel is equal to all the other mitzvahs. This is not just another one of the 613 mitzvahs. This is actually corresponds to all the mitzvahs in the Torah. It's equated with all the mitzvahs, which is a strong statement, which is not said about a lot of mitzvahs. There are a few others. I think keeping Shabbos is one, but this is a very central, very fundamental mitzvah in the Torah. And you see in that quote, he says that very clearly. And the Rambam Maimonides says also that the way the Jewish calendar is set up and the way the system is set up is that if there would ever be no Jews at all in the land of Israel, then the entire Jewish calendar would no longer be valid, which would mean that we don't keep any holidays, that we don't do anything. We don't function as Jews, essentially. And so the existence of Jews in Israel, which there always have been, there has never been a time when Jews have not lived in Israel since we became a people. There has never once been that time, but if Jews would ever leave Israel, and there would be no Jews at all, that would completely throw off our entire religious system. So that's a pretty bold statement about the centrality of the land. And there's a quote here from the Talmud Bavli, Babylonian Talmud, in source number 5, that anybody who walks 4 amos, 4 cubits, 7 feet or so, in the land of Israel, guaranteed a spot in the world to come. Okay, it's a pretty good deal. How that works exactly, not so clear. Probably it means that if you walk 4 cubits in the land of Israel and you understand what you're doing, then you're obviously in a place where you tap into the essence of the Jewish people. And so, I mean, all Jews are guaranteed a spot in the world to come, which is also good news for a lot of us. But certainly if you walk 4 in the land of Israel. And Talmud there also says, this is the end of Tractate Ksuvos, there's like 5 or 6 pages full of these quotes about the land of Israel. It says that literally the air of the land of Israel causes people to become wiser.
Okay. Good.
Right.
You can let go of
everything else. You're living, you're an Israeli now. That's a good point. That's a very valid point. That's true. So, what we're saying is that don't think that by making Aliyah that's the only thing you have to do. In fact, now that you made Aliyah, you can properly fulfill the mitzvahs the way they're supposed to be fulfilled. So this is actually the time to redouble your efforts to be observant of those mitzvahs as well. Although we do find that Jews who live in the land of Israel, even if they're distant from their Jewish roots, have a certain element that makes them spiritually elevated that they wouldn't have if they were in the land of Israel. The Talmud says, better to live in the land of Israel in a city that is entirely full of idol worshippers rather than live outside the land of Israel in a city full of Jews. So this is an example. There are several quotes like this where, but the point is certainly valid, and people who do that are definitely in error. So the land of Israel makes a person wiser. And I see there were some skeptical nods before, but just to add to that, there's a fascinating story in Tractate Nedarim, and for those who don't have a lot of familiarity with learning Talmud, there are a lot of colorful, out there, outlandish, possibly sounding stories in the Talmud, so we'll take this one with a grain of salt, but listen to the story. There was a rabbi named Ula who was traveling from Babylonia, which is Iraq, modern Iraq, to the land of Israel with two other fellows from the town of Chuzah. And they're traveling, and he just tagged along with them. You travel, you want to be with a group of people for security. And at one point during the travels, the two of them got into a big fight, and tragically one of them actually stabbed the other one to death. And so Ula is standing there, and the murderer turns to him and says, what do you think about what I just did? So Ula basically responds to the effect, he says, I think you did a great job, your technique is fantastic. Seriously, that's what he said, right? You know what you're doing. And because he was scared, this guy's a lunatic. He's just killing people in argument. You want to be on his good side, right? So he gets to the land of Israel eventually after the trip. And he goes to his rabbi, who is Rabbi Yochanan. And he goes to his rabbi and he says, Rabbi Yochanan, he comes to him in tears. He says, Rabbi, I just told a murderer that what he did was okay, right? Here I am. I should have protested. I should have stood up for what's right. This is a person committing horrible, horrible crimes. This is not a human being. He's an animal. I should have stood up. I allowed him. I encouraged him to do what he did. And Rabbi Yochanan said to him, don't worry. Said to the student, you had to do what you had to do. This was a man who, your life was in danger. If you didn't do what you did, then, who knows what would have happened to you. So Rabbi Yochanan says to Ula, he says, I don't understand. The verses say that the Jewish people outside the land of Israel will have a trembling heart. And that tells us that outside of Israel, people become angry. But is it possible that inside Israel, people would become so angry that they would kill each other? And and Ula said to Rabbi Yochanan, he says, in fact, the truth is we had not yet crossed the Jordan River. And so Rabbi Yochanan says, okay, I understand how that's possible. Because in Israel, nobody would get so angry. And that's why, of course, everybody who's been to Israel knows that Israelis are very calm and peaceful people. No, but the truth is that that as anybody who spent enough time there knows that in almost all circumstances, it's due to the fact that there's a feeling of family, that you're all in one family, and possibly the niceties that are due to strangers are not necessarily needed. But alternatively, this is referring, or it could be referring to an ideal state of a person who really understands what the land of Israel is about. Really, it is a place of peace. We know we're taught the Torah scholars of the land of Israel, they loved peace, they pursued peace more so than the Torah scholars outside of the land of Israel. That's just another example of how the land itself can affect the people who are living in the land. And in part B, it talks here about the land of Israel as a means for their perfection of the Jewish people. Now, this is a very, very important point, and this is, I believe, the point that was brought up over there, that people might think that living in the land of Israel is the end all. And the truth is, it's not. Because, as you know, the overwhelming majority of the Jewish people lived outside of the land of Israel for almost 2,000 years. Some have lived a lot longer than 2,000 years, right, away from the land, and maintained a strong Jewish identity. Right, Jewish communities have been in Rome for well over 2,000 years. Certainly, Ethiopia and other places. Right, even in Tunisia, there are communities that date back to the first Temple period, Egypt. So the land is not a prerequisite for our existence, right? But it's a means for us as Jews to strive for perfection. And by the way, this answers many of you are probably familiar with Mark Twain's famous essay where he talks about concerning the Jews, where he talks about the mystery of how the Jewish people have managed to do what they've done without a land, etc. And the answer is that it's because we are essentially defined by the teachings that make us who we are, by the Torah. And the land of Israel is the ideal place to keep the Torah, but it's not a requirement for us as people to exist. It's not what defines us. And just as an illustration of this, this is a story that I often think about, which I think is fascinating. Just an illustration of how Jews have been able to maintain their identity under all types of crazy conditions throughout history. There's a story, and it's a true story written in a first-person account by a young woman who was, I believe, working for the Jewish Agency, and she was sent to one of these absorption camps after the Ethiopian Jews, a certain wave of them, came from Ethiopia to Israel. And these were people, some of them who came from extremely isolated villages. There were more populated areas and there were more isolated, far-flung villages. And so there she is with these Ethiopian girls, literally fresh off the plane, and she's telling them, teaching them the Aleph Bet. And she teaches Aleph stands for, I don't know, Avatil Bet stands for Beit HaMikdash, the Holy Temple. And she says to them, which was destroyed 2,000 years ago. And so she sees the kids are looking at each other. A girl raises her hand and she says, can you please repeat what you just said? She says, yeah, Bet stands for the Beit HaMikdash, which was destroyed 2,000 years ago. And the girl stands up and runs out of the room. And the teacher's confused. She doesn't know what's going on. A few minutes later, the girl comes back with her entire tribe, her entire extended family, parents, grandparents, whatever. And they turn to the teacher and say, why are you lying to our child? And the teacher says, I'm not sure what you're referring to. All I am doing is teaching them the alphabet. She said, our child is telling us that you're telling her that the second temple was destroyed. And the teacher's like, well, it was destroyed. And like they said, are you serious? And she said, yes. And so she says, on the spot, they all tore their clothing. They sat on the floor, started crying, sobbing. These were people who were so far flung, so far removed from any organized Jewish community. First of all, they certainly never heard of the Talmud and the Mishnah. They'd never heard of the Hanukkah story, which is true. But they actually did not know that the temple was destroyed. And yet they maintained their Jewish identity for thousands of years, which is an incredible thing. And what we see is that it's not about the land, it's about the teachings that make us the people that we are. True story. It's a pretty mind-boggling thing. And just another illustration of this. Many of you have... There's a story that I saw printed. It was retold by Rabbi Norman Lamb, former chancellor of Yeshiva University. He tells the story of the time Elie Wiesel was talking to Yitzhak Rabin, Prime Minister of Israel, and he said to him, "What is your 30-year plan for the Jewish people?" And so Yitzhak Rabin says, "I don't know. I don't even know what I'm doing next week. How would I know 30-year plan or what's going to happen to the Jewish people?" So Wiesel said to him, he said, no, you have to have a longer vision. He said, let me teach you about one of the greatest figures in Jewish history. He says, when the Second Temple was about to be destroyed, and Jerusalem was going to be razed, and things were going to be really bad for the Jewish people, there was a great rabbi, a leader named Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. So many of you are familiar with the story. He smuggled himself out of Jerusalem against the will of many of its residents to meet with the Roman general. And he meets with the Roman general. Long story short, he basically... notifies the Roman general that he's going to become the emperor, and the general feels some kind of appreciation for that, and he offers to grant him his wish. And he says, give me the city of Yavne, which was an academy of Jewish learning, and the scholars of Yavne. And that's what he gets. And then the Romans roll in, destroy Jerusalem, destroy the temple. We no longer have that. But we do have these academies of great Jewish learning, and from that academy became the oral law as we know it today, the Mishnah, the Talmud. And so Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Elie Wiesel said to Yitzchak Rabin, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was able to put into effect mechanisms today that lasted the Jewish people through 2,000 years of exile. He said that's what every Jewish leader has to be looking at the long run. How are you going to create a environment that will last regardless of the circumstances of the Jewish people? When we're up and when we're down, we'll still be able to do that. So that's just an important point that it's about the Torah, but it's also, it's about the land of Israel, but it's primarily about the Torah as well. And the land of Israel, we're taught, is also the paramount location for Torah study. There's no Torah study like the land of Israel. We said that the land of Israel is a land that makes people wise, etc. And in part D, there's a great quote from Rabbi Samson Rafal Hirsch, who talks about how the individuals in a Jewish society play different roles, but they're bound by a common mission. And he says very eloquently, he says, of course, the Jewish people during the exile have not been able to practice a lot of the trades that we did when we were independent people. And now, thank God, in Israel, we are able to. But the notion of a Jewish farmer for thousands of years, probably at least 1,700 years, was a joke, right? Like Jewish athletes, right? So, but when a Jewish state is founded, the ability for Jews to inspire humanity through their efforts in all these different areas, these arenas, as businessmen, as soldiers, as a nation of science, is something that's unmatched. That the Jewish people, the Jewish state, can be a example for everybody. And one of Rav Avraham Yitzchak Kook's more controversial passages in one of his books, he says that young Jews in the land of Israel who exercise to become whether it's athletes or soldiers or whatnot, they are doing an extremely holy thing. What they're doing is almost as holy as what some of the great Kabbalists do, because what they're doing is they're creating an entire Jewish society of people that are not just Torah scholars. They're doing all types of different things, because once you infuse these seemingly mundane actions with the existence of Jewish statehood, it suddenly becomes something much holier than it would be on its own. And Rabbi Yehuda Halevi in the Kuzari, he emphasizes this a lot, that the purpose of the land of Israel is to rectify the world. And there's a quote here, a great quote from Rabbi Mordechai Becher, who points out that this is one of the reasons that there is a double standard when it comes to the world judging Israel and judging the morality of Israel. And some of it is anti-Semitic, but some of it comes from the fact that people look up to the Jewish people as beacons of what morality is, and they have a higher level of expectation for the Jewish people, especially when the Jewish people are operating in the parameters of statehood. And the spiritual qualities of the land of Israel are clear. Jewish people throughout history have come, they've risked their lives to come to the land of Israel. The divine presence is revealed there, and God's intervention is much clearer. We believe, certainly Kabbalistically, other countries have these other angels that somehow have some level of control over what goes on, but the land of Israel is exclusively God's domain, whatever that means, with an infinite God. But there, we have an ability to relate more directly to God. And prophecy, right, the ability to commune with God, to hear, to communicate with God, only exists in the land of Israel. And Rabbi Yehuda Halevi in the Kuzari, in his classic philosophical work, the Kuzari, he says that all prophecy is either in the land of Israel or about the land of Israel. There is no other prophecy. It's one of the two. That's how it is. And Rabbi Arya Kaplan quotes some interesting sources here as well that say that prophecy will return when the majority of world Jewry lives in Israel, which is something that I don't believe it's happened yet, but we're certainly getting closer to that. And in the tenth blessing of Shemona Esrei that we pray three times a day, that we pray that we should return to the land of Israel, we should sound the great shofar for our freedom, bring us back to Jerusalem, gather in the exiles. A lot of that is happening today. We're living through something extremely miraculous. Just an interesting gematria, numerology, is that the word shofar, that the ram's horn of redemption, is the same numerical value as the word Jerusalem. That's where redemption will come out. And just to recap something we said before is that there's a quote from the book of the Maccabees, which is part of the Hanukkah story and beyond, where I believe it was Yonatan, the last living son of Matasyahu, of the last sibling of Yehuda. He tells the Greek rulers, he says, Lo Eretz Nachriyala Kachnu. This is a quote that Naftali Bennett in Israel, minister of the economy, who's head of the Jewish Home Party, he's very fond of this quote. He uses it a lot. He says, we have not taken control of a foreign land. We have not taken away property which is not ours. This is the inheritance of our forefathers, which had once been unlawfully conquered by our enemies. And so with this conviction, right, with the fact that we know this is our land, this is given to us by God, historically has been Jewish land, it's essential to who we are as Jews. This is our identity. This cuts to the core of who we are. And then so with that, please God, when we say at the Passover Seder pretty soon, we say, L'shana haba b'Yerushalayim, next year in Jerusalem, hopefully it'll be a prophecy, not just a prayer. I want to have a good night. Thank you.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.